Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max, coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law. We have some great programming coming up at the law school, including two events to let you know about right now and more to come. You can join us on Monday, April 15th for a state budget briefing with New York City Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer. She's the Deputy Mayor for Housing, Economic Development, and Workforce. I'm going to be talking with her in front of a live audience on the morning of Monday, April 15th, to discuss state housing policy that the city is seeking from Albany. Now, if we're talking on April 15th, we may or may not have a state budget deal by then. A state budget is due by April 1st, but it'll probably be coming in a little after that. If the parties in Albany have agreed to a state budget before that event on April 15th, then the deputy mayor will be able to react what is and isn't in the state budget around housing policy, especially. There's a lot of questions about what will and won't be included. And if they haven't quite gotten to a state budget by April 15th, then we'll discuss some more about what the city is looking for from Albany on housing policy and how it fits into the city's larger plans. So join us on the morning of Monday, April 15th. Also coming up, Thursday, May 9th, will be a city law breakfast with the New York City Department of Investigations Commissioner Jocelyn Strauber. So join us for that as well, coming up on May 9th. Open to the public, both events, but you have to register ahead of time. You can find more info and an RSVP at citylandnyc.org. And we're working on a lot more from the Center for New York City Law, so stay tuned. Of course, the in-depth conversations continue here on Max Politics. And today on the show, conversations with two New York State Assembly members representing different parts of the city who are now deep into state budget negotiations as a new spending plan, likely with a bunch of policy mixed in, is due by that April 1st start of the new state fiscal year. The budget is expected to come in around $235 billion for next state fiscal year. There are major outstanding questions, of course, right now as they get into crunch time of those negotiations around taxing and spending, allocations of a whole bunch of that money, and many policy issues on the table, highlighted by housing policy. So I'll be joined shortly today by Assemblymember Catalina Cruz, a Queens Democrat, and then stay tuned for Assemblymember Brian Cunningham, a Brooklyn Democrat. Both of my guests are working on interesting, specific priorities that they will discuss here on the show, and we'll also touch base with both of them on some major issues that are part of budget negotiations, particularly housing policy. Assemblymember Catalina Cruz represents the 39th District in Queens, including Corona, Elmhurst, Jackson Heights, Rego Park, and Middle Village. She's been an assembly member since 2019 and has worked on various issues focused especially on immigrant communities, including, of course, those in her immigrant-rich district in Queens. She's also worked on criminal justice reform, policies to help sexual assault survivors, housing issues, and more. I'll talk with Assemblymember Cruz about state funding and policies related to asylum seekers and immigrant communities, as well as other issues. Make sure you stay tuned later in the show for Assemblymember Cunningham. He's in his first full term in the Assembly after winning a special election. He represents the 43rd District in Brooklyn, including Crown Heights, Flatbush, and Prospect Lefferts Gardens. He's been focused on education, housing, and healthcare, among other issues. I'll talk with Assemblymember Cunningham, especially about what's happening around the SUNY Downstate Medical Center in his district, about his bill to allow faith-based institutions to build housing on their land more easily, and more. And again, I'll talk with both assembly members about state budget negotiations broadly taking place in Albany among the Democratic supermajorities of the state Senate and the state assembly. And of course, Governor Kathy Hochul, also a Democrat. Hochul laid out her executive budget and policy agenda earlier this year. And after weeks of joint legislative hearings on those plans, the two legislative majorities recently issued and passed their individual one house budget resolutions. And so those three sets of proposals basically set the framework for the final weeks of state budget negotiations. Some, but not nearly all, of the key questions include decision-making around state education funding levels to local school districts, any changes or funding levels related to Medicaid spending and policy. Those are the two biggest chunks of the state budget by far every year, education and Medicaid. And then there's also a whole bunch of other specifics, how much the state will pledge to help New York City pay for services for the large influx of asylum-seeking migrants that have arrived over the last 2 years, related policies. I'll get into some of that with Assemblymember Cruz, as I mentioned, and so many other spending and policy items, from how much state support will go to CUNY and SUNY for higher education, mental health services funding, how much they might add for cost of living increases for human services workers in the budget from nonprofits that the state contracts with. There's discussions about tax credits for families. There's the governor's proposal around a new artificial intelligence hub at the University of Buffalo. I'm actually hoping to have an episode of the podcast here focused in on that proposal about Empire AI, as the governor is calling it, and much more. Also on the table, of course, is the long list of housing policy. There's a lot of pressure on the governor and legislators to get to a grand bargain of sorts on a number of housing-related policies, either in the budget, which is where most people want to see it just get done, or in the legislative session to follow, which runs until early June this year. This is basically the number one longstanding crisis facing the state and New York City: affordable housing, the supply of housing. There's a lot of focus additionally on things like tenant protections and vouchers and other pieces of the puzzle. But housing is clearly the area where a lot of expectations are that the parties know, after not getting to a grand bargain last year, that they really should and need to get to something here this year. Much more with my two guests today in just a moment. First, Assemblymember Catalina Cruz, and then do stay tuned for Assemblymember Brian Cunningham. Very briefly, if you missed any recent episodes of the show, find them all in your podcast feed here at Max Politics. I've had some great recent discussions with a wide variety of guests. As we do around this time of year, we've been pretty focused on state policy and the lead up to the state budget, but not only those topics. I've been joined in recent weeks by, for example, State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Gennaris, really good conversation on redistricting and then state budget and policy. I've also been joined recently by the New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Ashwin Bhasin, by the New York State Inspector General, Lucy Lang, and a number of other great guests. So check them all out after, of course, you listen to this one with the two assembly members. And so now I'm pleased to welcome back to the show, though it's been a little while, Assemblymember Catalina Cruz, a Queens Democrat who represents the 39th Assembly District, which includes mostly the neighborhoods of Corona, Elmhurst, and Jackson Heights, as well as parts of Rego Park and Mill Village in Queens. Welcome. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Good to be back, Ben. I'm feeling good, even though it's freezing outside.
It is very cold today. We're speaking here on Friday, March 22nd. So we're speaking on March 22nd. And of course, in Albany time and this time of the year, it's state budget crunch time that we're just getting into. So, Assemblymember Cruz, tell us a little bit from your perspective, help people understand a little bit, where are we at right now with this budget negotiation? You've got the two Democratic majorities in the Assembly and the Senate have put out their one house budget resolutions and passed them. And the governor, of course, had her agenda out earlier this year. So now we get into the real sort of nitty-gritty of figuring out the budget. But where are we in that process of sort of getting to an agreement?
This year feels like a little bit of a different budget dance. In the past, whether it was the prior administration or even the early years of the current one, what we saw were big pieces of policy items that were very contentious that often resulted in a very, very late budget. I think this year we're either looking at an on time, or as the Long Island Railroad says, 5 minutes before, 5 minutes after, you're technically on time. Because I think, on most things, we are of the same thought. Yes, we want to increase money on education. Yes, we want affordable housing. Yes, there are other, big investments that need to be made. I think the big question is, How much and where? And, you know, our houses are at the top level are negotiating those pieces now. And I'm hopeful that we'll have an on time or a almost on time budget.
Right. The way the holidays fall, I had Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris on. We were talking about this. The way the holidays fall with Good Friday on March 29th and Easter on the 31st, it seems like it'll go into April at least a little bit, right? You guys are not going to get a deal done before March 29th, are you?
Look, if I was a betting woman, I would probably say we're going into the first week
Right.
of April. I'm also an optimistic one, and it would be great if we did it before we went into the holiday break. But, you know, I would rather have something be, you know, a few days late and get it done right than rush it.
What would you say right now, and point taken, that this year seems a little bit different? There don't seem to be that many really big, you know, items to wrangle over. Of course, there's always the nitty-gritty of the specifics of certain funding levels and different policies that might make it into the budget. Yeah, there's a lot of complicated factors always. But to your point that there aren't so many, you know, there's not another round of wrangling over bail reform, for example. To point to one of the big ones. What are the most, the biggest sort of outstanding items from your point of view? Clearly, it seems like the two legislative houses are pushing back on the governor's proposed changes to education funding to localities. And that seems like it'll probably be somewhat easily resolved, at least for this year, because there also is clearly the additional revenue to work with that can sort of plug in there, as the governor's budget director has already sort of said. Although the governor has sort of dug in a little bit on her view of the need for some changes to some of the education aid formula. But it seems like that one will sort of get resolved, although correct me if you disagree with that. What do you see as a couple of the biggest items that might be the key sticking points in these negotiations?
You know, I do agree that education is one of the big ones, and that it's a matter of how you recalculate this formula. I just don't see a universe where either of the houses or the governor is going to want to put a particular education district in peril, you know, and so I think we'll get to a good place in that. I think the other big items are, of course, housing. I don't think any of us can deny that we are going through a housing crisis that was only made worse post-pandemic. And I think, you know, funding for immigrant communities and not just immigrant communities, but to address the crisis that, frankly, the federal government has left us to handle on our own, are the two other big items that I think are still left on the table to be resolved.
We'll talk about housing in a minute, but let's stick with that last point you made, because this is obviously an area of focus for you. You represent communities in Queens with very large immigrant populations. These issues have been an area of focus for you from when you were not yet elected into office. You were working at the city council and in your work as an attorney, both in government and outside. So say a little bit about sort of your perspective when it comes to how the state should be budgeting, legislating on issues related to the many asylum seekers who've arrived over the last year and a half, 2 years, but also the broader sense of the city's immigrant communities, and including, of course, your district. What are some of the top priorities or even just ways of thinking about this that you bring to the table in these budget negotiations? Top line, you know, a lot of focus, right, is on Mayor Adams saying to the state, we need more funding help for services for asylum seekers, which is mostly just helping to fund shelters and other services. But a lot of that is just sort of money that goes into this system. The governor put a little bit over $2 billion into her budget. The Senate and the Assembly seemingly agreeing with that number. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of controversy over the sort of funding to send or make available to the city, I should say, for those services. But say a little bit more about how you're thinking about that and the broader issues at play here.
You know, when I think about this immigration crisis, one of the things I think about is the fact that my district has been living a crisis around our immigrant communities before it was even a popular phrase. I think it's hindsight is 2020. It always is. You know, you could take a look at how the city responded, how the state responded, how the feds failed to respond. But one of the things I always go back to is this is a crisis we all saw coming and did nothing about. To me, it's similar to the housing crash of several, you know, what was it, almost two decades ago, where we all know that we kept on making the wrong investment in the wrong thing. And the minute it came crashing down, we were all surprised by it. And we were not prepared for it. And so, you know, when I think about what the mayor has done, there's a lot of things I don't agree with the mayor. I've had my own conversations with him and his team. But the one thing no one can deny is he's been the only one trying to actually do something about this. Right or wrong, he's been the one actually there. And what I would love to see our state is stop thinking about this as a political downfall for the Democratic Party to address the needs of migrants, to address the needs of new asylum seekers, which, by the way, they are legally seeking asylum. And I always want to repeat that because, you know, folks want to use the I word or say they don't have the right to be here. It is an international right that has been enshrined in our country and throughout Europe for decades. And so they're here. What now? We asked for the federal government's help. They helped a year and a half, 2 years later, and they didn't do a good job at it because giving us work permits for only a portion of the people who needed and allegedly accelerating the processes of the processes of these work permits, but not fast enough, is doing nothing for the ability of these people to self-sustain. And it's one of the reasons why I proposed that we as the state create our own work permit, because what we want is people who can start working, who can become self-sufficient, who can put money into our tax coffers and allow us to better support the state, and who can go be self-sufficient and good contributing members of the New York economy and of the state. Yet what we're doing is creating a system that is forcing people to rely on emergency housing that is not extensive and that does not necessarily translate into permanent housing, to rely on food pantries that don't ask for immigration status, to rely on services that, frankly, if they had a work permit, we wouldn't even have to have this conversation. And so for me, I think what the state should be doing is let's look to invest. Let's look at this as an investment. I don't know if you saw the report that the city comptroller did about a week, 2 weeks ago. You know, you're looking at about 53,000 New Yorkers that if we gave them legal services so that they could then go through their path to become permanent residents, citizens, and that means a work permit, and that means possibly owning your own small business. That means ability to pay your own rent and your own way through the world. We are looking at more than $8 billion, that's with a B, of money back into our economy, money back into our coffers for the state to be able to manage the services that we as a state should be providing to all New Yorkers, regardless of when they got here or who they are. But instead, we're focusing on only emergency housing and only the emergency that's right in front of our face. We need to start planning better, and we need to make sure that we are putting people on a path to self-sufficiency.
Tied into that report from the city comptroller's office was support for your legislation, the Access to Representation Act. Will you say a little bit about what that would do? And does it seem like there is some political momentum behind that? Does it have any prospects for passing? You know, sort of first on the substance of it, then on the sort of politics of it. Tell us a little bit about that bill.
So this bill comes from the concept that everyone who faces a court should have an attorney. In criminal cases, the Constitution guarantees you an attorney, whether you can afford it or not. But in immigration, because it's technically civil, but you still have repercussions that are aching to those in criminal court. You're ripped out from your country that you've known and sent to another place. Sometimes you could even end up in prison, depending on what immigration type procedure you're looking at. Why are we not guaranteeing people an attorney? Attorneys in immigration court can be as much as, if actually as little, because they can actually be more than $10,000. I'm looking at retainers of $10,000. What brand new immigrant can't even pay rent, but they're going to have $10,000 to go into immigration court. And we have seen study after study show that when you give an immigrant who's facing deportation, who's facing an asylum case, an attorney, their ability to actually win the case is almost like 70% more than someone without one. And so the concept between, you know, that behind the ARA is someone who steps into court should have an attorney. We began this, actually the first time they began investing into this was before my time. It was under former Senator Peralta who created the first version of this program. $10 million were put into it. And every year we've sought to increase the amount. Last year, we got a pretty significant amount, but it was not enough. You know, we are looking now at possibly, hopefully getting 150 million. There's now 74 in our one house. And the idea is that these should be attorneys, social safety net services surrounding the family or the individual getting those services and making sure that they can go into court, find their path to citizenship and become these new New Yorkers that that are going to contribute to making our state better.
The controller's report you mentioned from City Controller Brad Lander's office mentions that there's the potential for providing access to attorneys for all immigrants in New York State facing deportation proceedings could result in roughly 53,000 New Yorkers being able to remain in their communities across the state. And that could result in an estimated net benefit of $8.4 billion for the federal, state, and local governments, calculated as the net present value over 30 years of new tax revenues, less the services received. So in terms of the economic benefits of allowing immigrants to stay in the country and become working members of their communities. You were involved in helping draft some of the legislation in New York City that created some of the sanctuary city laws, other immigrant-focused policies like the IDNYC, Municipal Identification Program, which is obviously open to more people, but was very much targeted at immigrant communities, including undocumented New Yorkers. As some people hear you talk about the Access to Representation Act, and there's obviously with the influx of asylum seekers over the last year and a half, a lot of attention on sanctuary policies. Say a little bit about what you think people are getting right, wrong about this. When people hear you talk about sort of a universal right to representation in immigration court, some people might immediately jump to, well, why do you want to allow people breaking the law to, you know, stay in New York and stay in the country? So say a little bit about your perspective right now, as so many of these issues have become attached to the asylum seeker situation that the state and the city are facing.
And I think this is actually a great way to talk about the political will to pass access to representation, because I think it goes hand in hand with how the world is viewing what is a sanctuary city and what is not. I think Fox News and its kin have done an excellent job at misinforming the public about what a sanctuary city is and what it really means. Now, under the Constitution, we all have the right to be presumed innocent until found guilty. That's in criminal court. I don't understand why any of that should change or would change when it's in immigration court. If someone in immigration court is accused of having violated the law, it is civil law, not criminal law. It is civil law, but the penalties can often be just as harsh. And so if we're looking at two similar concepts in the law, why is one more deserving of providing someone with representation and the other not? Is it because it's immigrants? Is it because most immigrants are people of color? You know, I'd like to think that our Constitution does not distinguish between the color of your skin or if you've been in our country 5 minutes or 50 years. I think our Constitution protects everyone, or should at least protect everyone equally. And that is the concept behind the Access to Representation Act. That is the concept behind what a sanctuary city is supposed to be. What it's supposed to be is we as the state are going to enforce our state laws. we as the city are going to enforce our city laws. If someone is accused of having broken a law in our city or in our state, we are going to put them through the system accordingly, and they will receive the appropriate penalties. However, if you federal government want to come into our state or our city and pick that person up, we are not going to aid you at your job. You will have to do that on your own. You'll have to find whoever the immigrant is, put them in removal proceedings, and go from there. We are going to protect the people in our state and make sure that when you want to do your job, you're doing it on your own. That's the concept behind it. It isn't we're going to stop you from enforcing the law. It's simply saying it's not our job. We're going to stick to what we know how to do, which is enforce the state law, enforce the city law. Additionally, in a city like New York that, you know, was founded by immigrants, and actually this is a good kind of, I'm going to put a pin in this for a second, and I want to remind the folks who are listening that this is not the first quote unquote immigrant crisis we've had, but it is the first one where people look like me, where people are brown, where people are black, where people are coming from countries that, one of the presidential candidates on the Republican Party wants to demonize and has been demonizing even when he was president. But we've gone through this. There's been waves of Irish, there's been waves of Italians, there's been waves of other European countries. Then you have Cubans, Colombians. You have had this happen in our nation throughout, since its inception, periodically. But we are here now. And what we love to do as a country is to say it's the immigrant's fault or it's the poor person's fault. And so I think it's time we start to think about and remember the roots that made our country what it is, that made New York the wonderful place that it is. We are the kind of place that looks at everyone, we should be the kind of place that looks at everyone and says, we're going to give you an opportunity no matter where you came from and where and how long you've been here. And I think that's the part where we're failing. We are not giving people real opportunities. We're saying, here's emergency housing. Here's you waiting 6 months to a year for a work permit. And then when you do that, then you can move on. We are not prepared as a state, as a city, as a country to have dealt with what we have to deal with now. But going back to, I'm going to unpin that for a second.
Sure.
But going back to the way that I view what we have done is allowed extremists to change the narrative of what New York has always been. We were a sanctuary city for everyone before the word sanctuary became demonized. It is where people came for a better economic future, for freedom of religion, for freedom of sexual orientation or how we identify. It is and has always been that. And even if we took away the definition or the law, which I hope they don't, from the books, we will still be that. We just have to remember that that is who we have always been.
Let me ask you on the work permit front, because this is obviously so much the crux of the issue, because when people, the mayor, Mayor Adams's comments have obviously been sort of all over the place on a lot of this, sort of vacillating a bit between being welcoming and supportive and then talking about, migrants and the migrant crisis as destroying the city in certain ways and all sorts of comments across the board. But one of the things he's been, pretty consistent on is this idea of if we allowed people to quickly work and have, legal work permits, we would have a lot less of a strain on the city's coffers and we would have a lot less of a challenge here just generally in terms of integrating a wave of new immigrants, as you're getting at, like has happened in the past, but the big difference being this challenge with the ability to work. And then, as you noted, there's been some changes in federal policy, but not nearly applying to many, many of the folks who have arrived over the last year and a half seeking asylum. You mentioned the idea of a state work permit program. The governor said she considered it, but that her team sort of concluded that they wouldn't be able to protect businesses, that there could be ramifications around that. That seemed to sort of quiet the discussion around that. Is there any live discussion about creating some sort of state work permit program, or where do we stand on this issue? Is it more that there needs to be more lobbying at the federal level? There doesn't seem like there's going to be much action out of Washington, D.C. before the election. Anything that you sort of think could break the issue open here, or is it really just it's a federal matter that needs federal attention?
I wish I didn't have to introduce a bill like this. If the federal government had gotten its act together, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I agree with you. There probably won't be any movement until the election happens. And I think it's very unfortunate. Political fear, actually on both sides of the aisle, often stalls progress. A few decades back, I remember there being a pretty popular bipartisan immigration bill that ultimately died because both sides of the aisle were too fearful. And in the meantime, our localities and throughout the country and at a local level are left to deal with the mess that the federal government refuses to fix. This all goes back to Republicans historically stalling what we know needs to be fixed. So on the one hand, we're saying no immigration reform. And on the other hand, we're saying, but the people who are still here, they can't work. But at the same time, we're saying, but they should work. And so they need to make up their minds because we're trying to make this happen. But on the conversations just often go from that to demonizing someone, but not really going into the substantive. They complain and complain and complain, and we provide possible solutions. And everybody's like, no, but that's the wrong one. Well, then give me the right one. Tell me if you federal government aren't going to do your job, if you governor are saying that this is not the answer, then give me the answer, because we have been trying. I unfortunately at a leadership level, because it felt I think erroneously, once the president provided work permits for a significant amount of Venezolanos, it began feeling like the crisis was slowing down or over. And as you saw the mayor say recently, or I think his administration did, that as the weather gets nicer, we're expecting that there's going to be another surge of migrants. And in the meantime, we're still stalled with so many people not having work permits. My point of view on this is, there is some merit to what the governor is saying. And I think her team's underlying argument is that constitutionally, the law says that these powers rest with the federal government. Our federal law cannot, we cannot supersede federal law. But my bill and the way that we wrote it was akin to when we have stepped into the shoes of the federal government during a crisis. And so it would be for 2 years, and it would say, hey, we're in the middle of a crisis. Let us do this for 2 years. And when we are able to have you catch up, the federal government, or the crisis is no longer here, we don't need these permits anymore. Let's make them. It's not a permanent solution. It is it is something to do in the meantime, because we have to do something. We have to do something.
Measure.
Yeah. And it's an emergency measure. And then if the government would have wanted to sue us, let them sue us. We'll go to federal court and we'll defend it. And eventually my hope would be that this would be the law of the land. But somebody's got to have the guts to stand up to the federal government, because they refuse to do their job.
So on issues related to sort of this current asylum seeker crisis situation, when we get into the nitty gritty of this state budget that you're negotiating, there's obviously going to be some level of funding made available to New York City for reimbursements of services or provision of services, somewhere between $2 billion and $2.5 billion, probably. That sort of seems to be generally agreed upon. And you are fighting for at least a significant amount more funding that would get towards more legal representation. Anything else related to this that we should note here before we move into some other things in terms of either policies or budgetary items that you're working on this issue?
You know, on budgetary items, I'm also working, and I actually think we're in a very, very good place on funding for the Nourish New York program and other food emergency programs. The pandemic exacerbated the availability of food for New Yorkers. Many of them were undocumented, and these emergency programs don't ask you for your immigration status. Many just ask you, you know, your name and what, how much you need. And that's how it should be, frankly. And so Nourish takes state money, gives it to nonprofits to buy food from upstate farmers to make sure that, you know, we're also boosting the New York economy and keeping our small farmers alive, and then sends it to pantries. And I think it's been a very successful model so far. There's been, since 2020, more than 100 million pounds of New York based food has been distributed. And I think we're in a good place. We're looking at, you know, about 140 million dollars that we're seeking, and it seems like, you know, the executive and both houses know that this is a need. The other two big funding pieces are, and I don't know that it's big in the actual number, but in the impact, one is the Lorena Borja's transgender equity fund, which was created, you know, in honor of one of my neighbors here in Jackson Heights, Lorena Borjas, who died during the pandemic and was a trans Latina activist. And what we're looking to do is increase the amount of money that we provide for specific services for our trans community. That's everything from social services to employment services. We began with $1 million in investment. Last year it was about two or three, and we're seeking six million this year. But, you know, one that I hold very dear to my heart, other than Lorena, because Lorena was a dear friend, it's the Alex Jimenez Act. Sergeant Alex Jimenez was a young man from Corona who died in the Iraq war. He served our country. And while he was missing, because his body was actually missing for 2 years, his wife had to fight her deportation to the Dominican Republic. And, you know, a few federal electeds got involved, and eventually she was allowed to stay. But, you know, we introduced this bill as a way to honor him, frankly, without knowing how important it would become to support our military immigrant families facing deportation. You know, this year, think about the fact that who doesn't appreciate on both sides of the aisle the sacrifice that many of these families make? Yet, we couldn't even pass at the federal level the deported veterans bill. Now, this bill would have given deported veterans the opportunity to come back into the country, as even if it's just the opportunity, it wasn't a guarantee. You know, these folks served our country, may have made a mistake, ended up getting deported, and we owe them that second chance. And we couldn't even pass that at the federal level. So my thought is to create a program in our state that's dedicated to providing support for immigrant veteran families on their path to citizenship. That's something as simple as helping them apply for citizenship or apply for permanent residency, and something as complicated as helping them find an attorney that actually provides legal services if they're facing a deportation, like Alex's wife did. We've passed this bill unanimously in the assembly since I introduced it about 3-4 years ago. And last year, for the first time, we passed it in both the assembly and the Senate. And unfortunately, the governor vetoed it. I think in part because there needs to be a fiscal investment attached to it. And we weren't able to get that in time last year. So our hope is this year that we can get $500,000 to initially set up the program and then go from there.
Interesting. Just a couple minutes left in our time together. So let me ask you again to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning, which I think everybody agrees on, that housing policy is obviously a major central focus of negotiations in Albany again this year. Last year, a few pieces of housing policy were agreed upon, but a lot wasn't found agreement upon. Just in our last minute or two here, what's your sort of approach to these discussions? Are you among the legislators who are sort of very supportive of getting to a grand bargain that includes a lot of pieces of housing policy, like some form of good cause eviction protection, some form of a replacement for the 421A tax incentive to get more rental apartment buildings built, and a few other of the sort of pieces of the puzzle there? Or are you only supportive of certain pieces and against other pieces?
I think, you know, we have to be realistic in that one solution doesn't fit all parts of the state. And so we need a combination. And what that ends up looking like is going to require all of us to, you know, have our voice heard. I've been speaking to leadership and to my colleagues about what's important to me. I want to make sure that whatever proposal we have includes either a good cause in its entirety, or at least the most important pieces of good cause that'll protect tenants. And I want to make sure that, you know, whatever new construction or commercial conversion or, you know, floor to ratio or 421, anything that is at the table must include real affordability, a stronger affordability, because I think that the governor's initial proposal did not have that. And it has to include protections for our brothers and sisters in labor. The inclusion of our unions and in the production, as well as the maintenance of whatever new buildings or conversions we have, has to be part of the discussion. It has to be part of the end product, because I think otherwise it's only going to work to make rich people richer and poor people poorer.
The prospects for some sort of grand bargain that could include the couple of policies I mentioned, but also things like, and folks should stay tuned because very shortly, you'll hear my conversation with Assemblymember Cruz's colleague, Assemblymember Brian Cunningham, who is the lead sponsor of the Faith-Based Affordable Housing Act. And we'll talk about that. But that piece of the, you know, there's a lot of different housing policies that are on the table here. There's also the potential creation of a state housing voucher program. There's a lot of different pieces here. Is it your sense, though, in the assembly, especially because from my sense of things, the assembly is the of the three sort of negotiators at the table, the Senate, the assembly, and the governor, the assembly has been the sort of least enthusiastic about a lot of these different policies. Is it your sense that in your assembly majority, there is real sort of intention to get to a significant housing policy deal in this budget?
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it the least enthusiastic. I think we are reading between the lines and we're digging deep into, you know, what does real affordability look like? What is it in different parts of the community? Because we can be looking at affordability in Batavia, New York versus in Brooklyn, and it's going to look very different. So we're taking our time analyzing and scrutinizing it and having the conversation. But I think we are all of the same mindset. We cannot leave this session without some sort of solution for housing. And if we end up leaving budget, you know, our goal without it, our goal should be before June when we break for session, we have to have some sort of omnibus bill that includes a significant number of these pieces you just mentioned, especially tenant protections. But I just don't see how we get away from the idea that we do need to build more. But it can't just be built more and displace families and make it unaffordable for the people who have always lived there. It has to be build more, make it affordable, and protect existing and future tenants.
And as we say goodbye, any last legislative priority for the year you just want to mention? I know you have a bill that relates to prior work you've done on the Adult Survivors Act, or anything else you want to mention briefly here as we say goodbye?
Yeah, you know, this is a bill that, as we saw the window for the Adult Survivors Act, we saw, you know, news of, I think it was almost like 900 formerly incarcerated women filing suit against the state for sexual assault and, you know, and things that had happened to them. But when that window closed, you know, the statute of limitations kicked back in, and it left many of them feeling helpless because they had finally gotten to a place where they could talk about things that had happened to them, could seek justice, but justice was no longer there because of the statute of limitations. And for people who are not familiar with it, when you've been aggrieved by the city or the state government, you have to file a notice of claim within a certain amount of time. And when that expires, you just can't do it anymore. The statute of limitations won't allow you under the law. So what we're saying is for folks who are, you know, for women, for folks who are incarcerated, if they have been, if they're going to file a claim for sexual assault or other forms of assault, we are going to stall the statute of limitations until when they get out of prison. When they get out of prison, the clock can start again. They can go file the notice of claim. They can figure out what justice looks like for them. But it's impossible when you are incarcerated to know that you even have the right to do that, let alone to file that notice of claim.
Interesting. Well, we will leave it there, and we'll keep obviously an eye on that legislation and many of the other things we discussed here in budget and policy negotiations as the state budget gets toward the finish line over the next couple of weeks here, and then the legislative session to follow. Assemblymember Catalina Cruz, thank you for all the time and thoughts. Appreciate the conversation. Folks, don't go anywhere. More on the state policy picture and budget picture with Assemblymember Brian Cunningham coming right up. But Assemblymember Cruz, thank you again for the time, and be well.
Thank you for having me, Ben, and have a wonderful weekend.
And now I'm happy to welcome to the show New York State Assemblymember Brian Cunningham, a Brooklyn Democrat in his first full term in the Assembly. He represents District 43, which includes Crown Heights, Flatbush, and Prospect Lefferts Gardens. Assemblymember Cunningham, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Ben, thank you so much for having me on. I'm shocked that tomorrow's actually 2 years to the date that I was elected, and obviously going through my third budget, but excited to be here. I'm happy to be in conversation with you and talk about what's happening up in Albany and how it's impacting.
Thanks for making the time. Appreciate it. And I didn't realize we were right on that anniversary. So happy anniversary on the occasion here. Just to remind listeners, we're speaking here on Thursday, March 21st, 2024. So the assembly member is referring to Friday, March 22nd. So we'll get into several of your specific priorities very soon, but let's start big picture here. You just wrapped up the week's business in Albany. Tell us a little bit about sort of where we are in the process here of getting to a state budget deal among the three major parties, your Democratic supermajority in the Assembly, the Democratic supermajority in the Senate, and of course, Governor Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor. Budgets due April 1st, start of the fiscal year. Lots of people expecting it to be at least a little bit into April this year, and hopefully not into May like last year. So where are we at in the process? What can you tell people in terms of how the parties are coming together around trying to find compromise on the different visions and the different spending plans and what policy should be in the budget and all that stuff? Where are we at right now?
No, I think you kind of framed it well, Ben. Well, look, we're 12 days out from the passage of a budget or potentially a passage. I do anticipate that the budget will not be as late as it was last year, but I still think there's a lot of details to be worked out. Obviously, the Senate had their one house last week. We had our one house. The governor has outlined her agenda very early in the year, both with her state of the state and also her executive budget briefing. And I think we're still, you know, getting closer and closer to a deal. I think obviously what's on the top of minds for many New Yorkers, particularly in this budget, is the elephant in the room, which is housing and making sure that we can do something in housing. Obviously, I think, you know, everyone has framed it as a stool with a couple of legs. We obviously need to get a good place on tenant protections. We need to get to a good place where we're doing some development, some version of 421A. Again, and we have to get into a place where there's a good labor agreement. And I think that's kind of where we are. Is I think once we get past the housing piece, I think everything else kind of falls into place. There's obviously harm helpless, the educational piece. But I think the big piece here is going to be education. I think the numbers bear out, they add up, and I think we're getting closer and closer, and I don't anticipate a late budget this year.
Okay. Some optimism. That's good. So we'll get into
that in Albany.
Yeah, we'll get into specifics on housing, but you feel like there's going to be some kind of significant housing package that is part of this budget. It's not going to be kicked to the weeks after the budget.
No, I think it's going to be in this budget. If we're going to do it on housing, I think that it has to come out of the budget conversations. Again, when New Yorkers across the state are looking at their own budgets and the affordability crisis that's going on, there's no way that we allow two sessions to pass without doing anything big on housing. I think the last time we did any major housing policy was back in 2019, where we did a lot of tenant protections and just before I got elected. So certainly I think we're overdue and quite a few wheels are spinning. There are a couple of tools in the toolkit that have been thrown out there, whether you're talking about office conversions, whether you're talking about the FAR cap, or whether you're talking about Faith-Based Affordable Housing Act and 421A, there's so much different moving parts and so much energy and bills around this stuff and conversations that I can't anticipate us not doing something substantial and significant in the next couple of days.
Well, many people listening to this will be relieved and happy and optimistic hearing you say that. Let's put a pin in that for a minute, come back to housing in just a couple minutes. Give us a couple other things that you see as sort of sticking points. You know, the State Assembly, as you often do, you decided in your One House budget resolution to really try to include a very minimal amount of policy that doesn't have a fiscal component to it. Yep. The Senate had a bit more policy and the governor had a lot more policy. So whether it's funding levels or items or policy items, are there two, three, four, I don't know, however many you want to list things that you just want to point to people that you think are kind of sticking, sticky items that need some real negotiation or that, you know, in your Assembly Democratic Conference is taking up a bunch of the conversation that's not the housing discussion? Any couple of things in there? I don't know if you want me to throw things out there for you, but are there a few other things, whether it's like illegal marijuana sale enforcement or, you know, mental health related policy or any of these things that were part of the governor's agenda and the two houses of the legislature took some different stances on? Any other stuff you'd throw out there for people that seem to be sticking points?
Yeah, I think obviously one thing that's an elephant in the room is obviously the piece about retail theft and making sure that we, one, protect the local shops. But I think there is obviously some organized crime that is where we should be having the focus of the conversation. But a lot of the conversation has been around penalties for low-level folks who are doing crimes of poverty. So I think that's a sticking point. We're just trying to figure out how to land that plane safely where we are able to protect the retail workers and protect folks who are doing that work, but also making sure we're going after the organized crime piece. Those are some other pieces that I think I would throw into the mix of the assortment of stuff that you mentioned already.
Yeah, that's on my list here too as a potential sort of one of the bigger ones that seem to be some disagreement. The governor proposing a sort of significant suite of ramped up penalties and funding for police and prosecutors to take on retail theft, and at least your assembly majority not agreeing to those increased penalties. But obviously there's a lot of live discussion there around how to combat retail theft. All right, some of your priorities. Let's start with the SUNY Downstate Medical Center in your district. The governor released a proposal in her agenda that would lead to closure of this hospital. Say a little bit about what you want to see happen with the facility, what's sort of at stake here, and how you're approaching this issue in these budget negotiations.
Yeah, let's be very clear on SUNY Downstate. SUNY Downstate is the pride and joy and a gem of the 43rd Assembly District. It's an obvious institution that's the fourth largest employer in Brooklyn and the largest employer in my district. So saving the hospital is obviously a priority for myself, and for many of my colleagues across the state, across the borough in general. One of the things we're trying to do with SUNY Downstate is do two things. We're making sure that we make sure we take care of the debt for SUNY Downstate. And the second part of that is making sure that the $300 million of capital the governor outlined as something that she's willing to do, making sure we get that $300 million in the budget, but bifurcating that from any future plans of closing the existing building and moving those services next door. What we propose is that we said that, look, we'll take the money, $100 million for the expense to cover this year's debt. We'll take $300 million for the future capital funds. But what we're going to do is we're going to have a commission actually study on the services that are needed at this new facility, whether or not this wing would be expansive enough to take care of the needs of Central Brooklyn residents, and making sure that we have no job losses from our labor partners at UUP. So I think there's a lot of discussions on this. This is obviously something that I don't think the governor or the chancellor anticipated us getting done in 3 months, given the timeline. I think they announced the full plan on January 15th, which is MLK Day. And there was no way we were going to get full negotiation by April 1st. So I think we are in a good spot at this point to negotiate, making sure we have the resources we need for the hospital to be around for the future, to invest that future capital, but to do that in a more deliberate way with a commission and a community advisory board to help guide and steer that conversation. Decisions about Brooklyn cannot be made 160 miles away from Brooklyn, and it has to involve the active participation of our residents who are going to be impacted by these services disruptions.
And I know you want to set up a task force and look at what's going on with the hospital and try to figure out, you know, the path ahead for it. What's your sense right now of what's gone on? There's lots of numbers that have shown, you know, patient and revenue drops. Obviously, COVID was a huge shock to the system for many hospitals and healthcare facilities, but there were also these trends happening at SUNY Downstate for years before the pandemic. What's your sense of sort of the main problems and potential solutions here?
A couple of things. One, we have to first address the elephant in the room, or the other elephant in the room, which is the federal government's reimbursement rate for Medicare and Medicaid patients. We know that that's 30% less on each procedure done. A lot of the people that go to SUNY Dallas, it's obviously a safety net hospital. So you're not having private insurance people actually come there in the volumes that we should. And so part of that is just first addressing that the federal government has to do more to fix the federal reimbursement rate. The second thing we have to do is begin to identify what capital repairs can be made, particularly given some of the services that SUNY Downstate already provides that are world-class services. But when you look at the outfitting of the building, it may not be a place, particularly when you think about maternal health. Right now, their maternal health ward has four women in a room sharing a shower. If people have the option of doing that or going to another private hospital, they probably are going to go to another private hospital, particularly since those private hospitals have people that do have private insurance, but also they have major problem, but we got on the reimbursement rates. And quite frankly, being very, very direct, the state has not invested in SUNY a lot over the last few years. You think about capital repairs. You look next door at Kings County, there's been a lot of capital in the last 20, 30 years. You look at downstate, not so much. So we have to make sure we get that done and get that done right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You have a variety. It was really interesting getting lists from your office. You have a wide variety of bills that relate to education. This is obviously a priority issue for you, given the list of bills that you're sponsoring or invested in. So you have a couple that seem to be, well, several of them that are very interesting to me, but I want to give you a chance to talk about ones that are at the top priority for you, which I believe relate to tutoring and also school-based laundry centers. Will you say a little bit about each of those and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Absolutely. So high-impact tutoring is actually a really big deal. What we've seen over the last few years is that we have had significant learning loss for children in school, particularly when you look at third grade reading and eighth grade math. Because of the pandemic, it kind of exacerbated an already existing crisis. What we're trying to do is double down and make sure that we're putting the resources where they need to be by providing this pilot program, which I think is about a $30 million, $50 million pilot program to help implement this tutoring services again, to address learning loss for a lot of these young people. And the other piece that we saw prevalent during the pandemic, as you mentioned, was the need specifically for laundry service. A lot of young people, obviously I worked in schools prior to becoming a legislator, I was an academic advisor. And what we noticed is that a lot of young people are kids who are in foster care, a lot of kids who are currently homeless, and a lot of kids who don't have the services at home for laundry. So what we are asking the state to do is to pitch in some money again for a pilot program where some of these young people who are having some economic challenges at home will be able to get their laundry done for free in school. So we think these are two bills that are aimed at some of the things we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years, just talking to our principals, talking to our superintendents, and working directly with families to make sure they have the service they need. School buildings, community centers, and we want to make sure we have all the resources they need in those buildings.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there are some schools in the city in the community schools program where school-based laundry has been part of that program. I'm not sure how many it is. Is this something that can work in, you know, potentially work in conjunction with that program, or have you been in touch with the city Department of Education around the community school program and the existence of any current laundry centers at schools?
Yeah, there are quite a few, but we've also identified a few areas where we need more of those centers. They don't exist now. So this would address getting at the solution now, opposed to kicking the can on the road to make sure those services exist. And again, this is something that, again, should be in all of our schools in the state, but certainly in the city. And we're just looking to make sure we scale that up a little bit by putting some teeth in some legislation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, these two top education priorities on high-impact tutoring and the school-based laundry centers, these are high priorities for you. Where are they in your ability to advance them in the assembly and in the budget if need be? Obviously, as a relatively new assembly member, sometimes it can be challenging to sort of get your specific priorities to the forefront. How's that going on these couple of items?
Well, funny enough, I mean, the big and running joke is that I passed 6 bills that the governor signed into law in 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about our 2 year anniversary. So we have been able to influence the process in Albany and actually get some meaningful things done in terms of high impact tutoring. I think, you know, the governor also had a very similar version of this in her state of the state last year, as well as we've seen places like Colorado and even the White House talk about this stuff. You know, if New York continues to talk about being the leader of progressive values and putting policies that are first in the nation, I think there's a lot of pressure on us to actually do some of this stuff. So I think there is enormous outside pressure for this to happen. There are a number of colleagues who are signed on to particularly the high impact tutoring bill. They get it. And I think it's something that we can actually get done in this budget. The reason why we didn't get it done last year in last year's budget, given the governor's interest in it, was the fact that we got a bill number a little too late to get that. And it has a fiscal. So we have to do fiscal things in the budget. So I think there's a lot of energy. We've been talking, obviously, with the second floor prior to the negotiations beginning. But certainly, I think the speaker gets it and wants to see something like this done, particularly in New York State.
Before we come back to housing, the other one that jumped out at me in your education portfolio is about requiring public school districts to provide language assistance to limited English proficient parents of students. In a former life before I went to journalism, I don't think we've talked about this. I was a teacher and certainly ran into some of these challenges with first-generation students, first-generation immigrants whose parents didn't speak English. And this was before we, you know, had the ability even on our phones to very quickly translate for each other in person. You know, there's some real barriers sometimes to communication. And also, obviously, this again is a way, like you're talking about with tutoring, with laundry centers, you know, a way to make schools into even more of, you know, community hubs and create more continuity. Say a little bit about this bill and maybe where it comes from in your district. Is this something that's become an increasing challenge that you've noticed in your district, or any particular sort of backstory to this bill? And if this is in the discussion at all in terms of advancement?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has always been an issue in our district, right? I think, you know, I represent a community of Flatbush, Crown Heights, Prosper, Lefferts, where Flatbush is by far my most non-English speaking in terms of the Haitian community that lives in Flatbush. And they've had these challenges for a while. I think, you know, we've done a good job at piecemealing some of the non-English pieces into our education with the students who are learners, but we haven't done a good job with reaching out to those parents. And oftentimes what happens is you're finding this disconnect from what a child is told to what the parent knows. So I think it's seeing those trends. What we've always done in my office is we look at the trends that are in our district, the things that we hear about from our school leaders, and we bring them to the forefront of trying to find legislation that's common sense that can help address those things. Now, this is one of those bills that I think are out there. Do I think this is going to be a bill that passed this year? Probably not, but I think with the increased amount of migrants and others that are coming to the city at record numbers, and they're speaking a whole host of languages, not just the traditional language we're used to seeing here in the city, such as Spanish and Haitian Creole, I think this is going to only deepen the need for us to address this from a state policy perspective. Obviously, the city has a lot of autonomy of education, but in terms of curriculum, the state has a lot of power there, and we have to exercise that might to the full degree to make sure every child and every family has an opportunity to be successful here in this country and in the city.
All right, let's come back to housing. So you have a particular bill that you are the lead sponsor of that's part of this conversation in potentially getting at least some pieces of housing policy passed this year. In the beginning of this conversation, you obviously expressed a lot of optimism about a grand bargain, bigger package coming together. And I think there's obviously a lot of discussion on that. But say a little bit about your faith-based Affordable Housing Act.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all acknowledge, Ben, that housing is the biggest issue in everyone's mind. We have people who work in New York City that are driving as far as Pennsylvania and beyond to get to work in the morning. We've had a lot of people go down to 95 moving out of New York because of the lack of affordability. Now, there are two, again, things with the affordability and the housing crisis. One, there is the affordability piece, which we have to address by doing more subsidies. The second piece is really the supply. We're actually really at a low vacancy rate at this point, and we have to try to actually get more housing built. What this bill would do when enacted is it would take existing houses of worship, those are church, mosques, and synagogues that are owned by those religious institutions, and allow them the ability to build housing on their land. Obviously, there's been a lot of red tape that have prohibited some faith-based organizations from doing this. Some of those things are just basic things like people that go to school to preach and teach the good word aren't developers and don't have that kind of sophistication. So in this bill, we have a component that would make sure they have the training they need so they're not taken advantage of by unscrupulous developers. But it also addresses a real need they have, which is building housing for the communities they are seeing leave their communities. So this has a little bit of a, it's more of a zoning bill because there are certain parts that just won't develop housing. So this bill helps us unlock some of that and begin to build truly affordable housing with a willing and able partner. This is not a mandate. Faith-based organizations have an opportunity to do this. It doesn't mean they have to do this.
Hmm. Say a little bit about what you think the sort of potential is here. There's potentially billions of square feet of housing that could be built, based on studies of this land that would be available. And obviously, as you're just getting out there, nowhere near every faith-based institution is going to want to build housing on their land. But what do you sort of see as the potential here? Do you have any sort of estimates about, even in just New York City, where this could go?
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at just how much housing we would specifically get with the office vacancy or the office conversions. This actually doubles that number. And it also helps to limit density. With the office conversions, that would just impact New York City proper. But we know from Buffalo to Brooklyn, there's housing needs, and there are churches all across the state, houses of worship all across the state that are both in need of some capital repairs for their physical imprint or where they actually do their services. And some places want to build schools and build food pantries, but the real thing is building housing. And this would actually double that number on the office conversion piece of the amount of units that we'd have available just based on the low end estimations.
And there are faith-based institutions that already do this, right?
Absolutely. Abyssinian. The Christian Cultural Center. There's so many examples here in Brooklyn and the Harlem and beyond. But again, some of this ties into where they are located and the zoning for those areas. So this is really where it gets at, is making sure that every part of the state plays their fair share in making sure this is a reality.
Are you getting pushback on this? Do you think it's sort of got a runway here to passage in a housing package that comes together? I mean, this bill is relatively new. But as we just got at, the issue is not new. You know, faith-based institutions have been building housing for a very long time. What's the forecast here? I mean, obviously, a lot of this gets tricky because of how you and the Assembly, as I mentioned earlier, approached your One House budget, stripping out so much of the policy. Sure. We know, of course, that you as the Assembly majority are open to a bunch of policy in the budget. That's more of your sort of principled stance that you don't think a lot of policy should be in the budget, but we know there's going to be a bunch of policy in the budget. So yeah. Tell me a little bit, are you getting any pushback on this bill? Do you think it's got a very strong chance of being part of the package? Is it a little bit too new as you got at with some of the other stuff here? Where is this at in terms of its viability?
Look, me and Senator Gonzalez introduced this bill back in December, right before session started. In the Assembly right now, we have about 30 co-sponsors. This is probably, and the reason why this bill is getting so much traction is that this is probably one of the most significant housing policies that have moved so quickly in terms of both bodies. In fact, to your point about the policy, the Senate actually made this language very much the hallmark of their housing policy in their One House document. So there is a lot of traction. I think there's a lot of need. And I think a lot of clergy and faith leaders have called their elected officials and echoed that this is something they want, something they need, and something that will help baseline one growth in the housing market, create affordability, and maintain the footprint of these faith-based organizations. I've said, we even have the support of the housing chair in both houses. What I have said, and I want to be very clear on this, is that we are in danger of those faith-based organizations selling their home, their churches and mosques and synagogues to private developers. So this has to be part of the calculation that if we're going to do for a new version of 421A, if we're going to do Make sure we do take care of the wage situation with labor, brothers and sisters, that we also have to make sure we focus on this new supply that's going to come online to actually unlock the opportunity for so many people to remain and stay in New York City and New York State where they want to be. So I think this has a really good shot, particularly given the fact that the chairs have both signaled it. It's in the Senate one house, and a lot of members, again, over 30 members in the assembly and much more counting, are getting on board. There is some, obviously, some pushback, particularly in parts of like Long Island, where, you know, it's been the thought that they've always said no to anything that increases density. But this is an old playbook out of Robert Moses and how he engineered the city. We have to fight back against some of this zoning blockages that have blocked us from building housing up and down the state and keeping New Yorkers housed, affordable, and living here in our state.
And you, I mean, you have some sponsors on this bill in both houses who are not particularly what we would call pro-housing on many other bills. So that's also worth pointing out. I won't name names right now.
Listen, I've been one of the most bipartisan Democrats in the majority. We've been able to work with both sides and address their concerns, and happy to look at red lines that make sense. But when it doesn't make sense, if this is just another obstacle to building truly affordable housing, we will not stand for that. But if they're legitimate concerns, we're willing to look at this bill critically and make the amendments and the adjustments to make sure it gets passed. But this is a critical piece of legislation. I intend to make sure this bill, among the high impact tutoring bill and Melanie's law, passed in this session.
You have in the bill certain height limits for different localities in the state. Now, obviously, in anything that comes together in the state budget, some of that could get changed, negotiated up, down, sideways, whatever. But, you know, for people listening in terms of points you've made about density and so forth, I mean, you've written it that specifically that there's even, you know, sort of contextual height limits noted in the bill.
We try to be very reasonable and accommodating and thinking about the fact that everywhere in the state does not look the same. If this is a New York City bill, it's a very different bill, but we are trying to make sure that across the state, people can live and remain where they are. And that's why we've tried to make so much adjustments, be very specific in contextual zoning and height density and where those densities can occur. So I think we're in a good spot with this bill. I think we've listened to enough colleagues. We'll continue to listen. We'll continue to make modifications as necessary, but I think we're in a good place.
You are listening to New York State Assemblymember Brian Cunningham here on Max Politics. He's a Brooklyn Democrat representing the 43rd Assembly District, which includes Crown Heights, Flatbush, Prospect, Lefferts Gardens. Let's talk about housing for a few more minutes before I let you go, or I might try to hit you on one or two more quick things, actually. But on this, you sound, and so correct me if I'm wrong, you sound here like a legislator who is one of the sort of like, we got to do a big package of housing, right? You've said that already a couple of times, so you don't have to confirm that. But you strike me as you're kind of let's do it all virtually of the major housing policies that are on the table here. You sound like you're someone who's like, let's get to yes on all of these. We got to take on this crisis in a big way. Is that accurate? Or are there pieces of the housing policy discussion that you have major concerns about?
Look, I think I am describing myself as a FDR housing Democrat at this point, that we have to do a little bit of everything to actually address the issue and get people in the conference comfortable. There are some people in the conference who are, they only want to talk about center protections. Certainly, I think there's a need to do that. There are some folks who want to ignore the fact that we have to develop more, and by developing more, we have to provide some incentive to developers. I am not there either. I think we have to kind of do a big package because we have such a big issue that we've allowed to fester for so long. So there's no way we can come into this session after not doing anything since 2019 and not do something huge. It's going to have the most impact on the most amount of people in one of the greatest states in the country.
Are you, you're a co-sponsor on Good Cause Eviction.
I am.
I'm
a sponsor for the FAR bill. That's my bill. I'm all over them. I have a bill actually that gets at the federal government and says, look, the average medium income should really look at the community-based incomes. I have a CMI bill that says that the federal government should change their policy on how we look at incomes. Westchester and Brooklyn are two different places. The Bronx and Staten Island are two different places, believe it or not. The incomes vary. You can't look at a sleeping AMI and say, and that's why we have this housing problem, because we have people who are never going to make enough, right, based on low income, low wages. And there are people who went to school and are have a good job, a good union job, and they make a little bit too much and they get priced out. So, and then we have a middle class that's just can't afford to save enough to buy a house. So yes, we have to have an all of the approach strategy, because we have people in every category across every part of the state struggling with where they're going to put their kids are themselves under a roof, right?
I mean, you have, yeah, I mean, you have, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I live sort of not too far from your district, and have a bit of a sense of it, but I know this is true of other parts of Brooklyn and parts of Queens and Manhattan and the Bronx and parts of Staten Island even maybe. But you have a district, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's almost like you have a district here where you've seen a lot of displacement, a lot of, you know, gentrification. And by that, we mean sort of displacement and very often demographic change, where you have very often higher income, whiter residents coming in, pushing out lower income, medium income residents of color. Then you have a lot of those families or individuals then starting a family, and then they're moving out of the city because so you have this like chain of events that's kind of brutal for everybody. Go ahead.
We're looking at potentially having, and it's why we got to do both at the same time, because what we don't want to do is create a situation we have empty houses and empty buildings. So we have to do both at the same time. I've certainly seen that. I got into this fight about politics a few years ago because of that, right? We've seen incomes stagnated, we've seen wages on the decline, and we've seen people's rent soaring. And it's making people make some tough decisions based on where they are in life. Like I said, there's a variety of people that need a variety of solutions as it pertains to housing. So we don't have the luxury anymore to kind of pick and choose. This is no longer an a la carte situation. This is an and or situation. We have to figure out how to do big things on housing. So, you know, me and my conference, we're prepared to do that. I think there are people with that fall into different categories of it. But if we have an omnibus bill that protects tenants, that builds new housing, that gives some reasonable tax breaks to developers who are trying to do responsible affordable housing, we take care of labor and make sure that labor has the right wages and prevailing wages, then we're in a good spot to actually do something huge, keep people here, and actually move to the next big challenge of our lifetime, which is going to be AI and all these other things that are killing jobs in our state. So we have a lot of work to do. We can't keep fighting the same fight year after year. We have to get it done this session.
You know, you just got at this, which I was going to ask you. The last thing on housing is whether there really is majority support in your conference for this general outlook that you're portraying here, because my sense of where the Assembly Democratic majority is that there isn't that sort of real oomph that you're describing. Maybe not people necessarily being at your level of oomph, but you know, that there isn't necessarily that much support. You know, there's like a group that supports good cause, a group that's, you know, kind of for incentives for building, but not necessarily sort of this bigger consensus for like, we got to do a variety of these together in a big omnibus bill. But you're saying you feel that energy from your colleagues that it's really there?
I feel that energy when I talk to my colleagues one-on-one. I think, you know, the thing is, Twitter is louder than real life and louder than the chamber. There are real conversations where I think what people have said to us to Albany to do, or what they send people to DC and City Hall to do, is to negotiate. That is not a bad thing in politics, to figure out that we cannot get everything we want at the table, and there'll be mistakes that we look back and try to retrofit. But at the end of the day, people send us here to do big things that are hard. And that requires a level of political maturity to actually get those things done by sitting at the table, eyeball to eyeball, and figuring out how do we get to a solution that's going to impact the lives of so many New Yorkers. 20 million New Yorkers live in this state. And we have to figure out that Buffalo and Brooklyn look very different. Syracuse and Schenectady look very different. We have to figure out how to find something for everybody in this state so that we can continue to, again, be the Empire State that people envy.
Last two questions for you, and appreciate the time. It doesn't seem like mayoral control of New York City schools is going to be extended in the budget. There's obviously a state study from the education department that's due soon. And then, you know, I've had State Senator John Liu, who chairs the City Education Committee in the Senate, on the show. And he said he has no plans of, you know, sort of dealing with this in the budget. And others have said similarly. But I just wanted to gauge your stance generally on mayoral control and what you see coming up on that, where you're trying to weigh in on what you think is right for your constituents on control of the school system and what that looks like going forward.
Look, I think we did not do mayoral control in the last budget. We did it post-budget. I think we will get to a place where we do get some version of mayoral accountability done. I think the thing that we have not done since the beginning of Mayoral Control, which I think started under Michael Bloomberg, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, was we haven't done a look back to see what system would be different, if we, what system is it to go back to, right? We haven't had school boards control in a very long time. So I think with this passage, we also have to be very clear that if people have opposition to mayoral control or mayoral accountability, however people describe it, is that we have to have a system in which we're saying we're moving towards. New York City is a city like no other city in the country, certainly a city like no other city in the state. There are certainly a number of things that New York City wants control over, including speed cameras and a bunch of things. And we, that is, as a state legislator, we've seen that the five boroughs, the almost 10 million people that live there, that's kind of a little bit different in terms of how their government operates. So I don't think I would be a vote against mayoral control. I don't think it's 4 years, certainly. And I certainly think there needs to be a more comprehensive package of things we attach to it, benchmarks we want to see by the next report card, if you would, of the mayor after his control is over. And then certainly, if there is objections, we should certainly have a plan alternative. But we just can't say no mayoral control and haven't had a fleshed out conversation of what we would go to do at this point, given the fact that there's no alternative. Right. So I think we should have a report card system. Kids get report cards. The mayor should do and should get one specifically, not just for the big things, but every report card has math, science, reading. They're segmented. So we got to give him a grade on that particular item and how he's done with it.
Let's leave it there. Appreciate those thoughts on mayoral control. We're going to obviously keep talking about this issue in the coming months, as it is very, very, very unlikely to be done in the budget coming up. Assemblymember Brian Cunningham, really appreciate the time and the thoughts on your focus issues and some of these broader issues facing the state and where state budget negotiations are at. Thank you for taking the time, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the time.
All right. Be well.